The Practical Yoga Sutras, A Manual for a Steady Mind and a Well-Lived Life by Ganesh Gunasekaran. A note before you begin. This is a manual, not a scripture, and not a set of promises. It takes one of the oldest and most carefully organized psychological systems ever written down, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, and turns it into something you can actually use on a Tuesday. How to eat, sleep, breathe, pay attention, handle a difficult person, quiet a racing mind, and build a life that feels less scattered and more your own. Patanjali was not selling flexibility or fitness. The word yoga here has almost nothing to do with the poses that fill studios today. It means union, or more usefully, discipline, a method for training the mind so that it stops jerking you around. The entire system is built to answer one practical question. How do you stop being at the mercy of your own reactions? You do not have to believe anything metaphysical to get value from this book. Where Patanjali makes a claim that modern psychology or physiology can test, I tell you what the evidence actually says, including where the science is strong, where it is thin, and where popular wellness culture has wildly oversold it. Where he makes a claim that science cannot touch, about the ultimate nature of consciousness. For instance, I say so plainly and leave the metaphysics to you. The goal is a book you can trust, neither a debunking nor a sales pitch. If you have read my other books, this one has a specific job among them. The one who notices walks the same eight limbs through the lens of a restless, anxious, or suffering mind. It is the psychological companion. The long argument is the wider map of Hindu philosophy that this single school sits inside. This book is the complete honest manual to Patanjali's text itself. All four chapters, every limb, checked against the evidence. Rate them in any order, each stands on its own. How this book is organized? The book moves from map to territory. Part I, orientation, explains what the Yoga Sutras are, the single idea at their center, and the eight-part map, the eight limbs that the whole practice hangs on. The four chapters is a short, honest tour through all four books of the sutras, so that everything is covered is true and not a slogan, including the strange chapter on supernatural powers, which I treat rationally. The eight limbs, in practice, is the heart of the book and where you will spend most of your time. Each limb gets the same treatment. What Patanjali actually said, what it means in plain language, exactly how to practice it, what the science shows, and the common ways people get it wrong. Part 5. Obstacles and tools covers what gets in the way. Patanjali listed the obstacles with unnerving accuracy and the specific mental techniques he offers to work with them. Part 5. Programs turns all of it into routines. Use a day built on the sutras, an 8-week beginner progression, and a troubleshooting guide. Appendices give you a glossary, a blunt account of the evidence and its limits, a safety guide, a quick reference table of key verses, and the full list of scientific sources. How to read the science boxes throughout. You will find boxes marked what the science says. Each rates the evidence honestly. Strong, replicated, randomized trials, or good meta-analyses support this, moderate, consistent evidence, but limited by small studies or weak controls. Preliminary, early, mechanistic, or mixed, promising but unproven. Overstated, a real kernel that popular culture has inflated well past the data. A recurring, sobering lesson from the best research, especially Goyal and colleagues, 2014 review in JAMA Internal Medicine, is that these practices are real but modest in effect and rarely clearly better than other good things you could do. That is not a reason to skip them. It is a reason to practice them for what they reliably give, a steadier, kinder, more attentive mind rather than for miracles. A safety note up front, most of what is in this book is very low risk. Two areas are not and deserve care from the start. Vigorous or breath-holding breathing techniques can cause fainting. and must never be done in or near water or while driving. They are contraindicated in pregnancy, uncontrolled high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, and epilepsy. Intensive meditation, especially long retreats and many hours a day, can provoke real psychological distress in a meaningful minority of people. Both cautions are explained in detail where they arise and collected in appendix. If you have a significant physical or mental health condition, treat this book as a complement to professional care. And if you are ever in crisis or thinking about harming yourself, that comes first, before any practice in this book. Contact your local emergency number or findahelpline.com and befrienders.org will route you to your country's crisis line. What the Yoga Sutras are? Most likely around 400 CE, some 600 years ago, though older estimates run back a few centuries further. A compiler known to history as Patanjali gathered the meditative knowledge of his culture into 196 terse aphorisms called sutras, literally threads, the same root as the English word suture. Each sutra is a compressed line meant to be memorized and then unpacked by a teacher. Read cold, they can seem cryptic. Read with a guide, they reveal one of the most systematic accounts of the mind ever produced. Working manual for how attention, emotion, habit, and identity operate, and how they can be trained. The text is divided into four books called Padas. The first Samadhi Pada defines the goal and describes the deep states of absorbed attention. The second Sadhana Pada is the practical book. It names what corrupts the mind and lays out the eight-limbed path. The third Vibhuti Pada describes the refined powers of a highly concentrated mind. This is the famous and easily misunderstood chapter on siddhis or attainments. The fourth Kaivalya Pada addresses liberation, freedom itself. Patanjali did not invent yoga. He organized it. His genius was structural. He took scattered contemplative practices and arranged them into a sequence. A person could actually walk from ordinary ethical living all the way to the subtlest states of consciousness. That structure is why the text still works as a manual today, and why this book can be organized around it without much modern editorializing. A key point for the modern reader: the Yoga Sutras are barely about physical posture at all. Of the 196 verses, exactly 3 mention asana, the poses, and they do not describe a single one. Asana in Patanjali means essentially a steady, comfortable seat for meditation. The vast global enterprise of postural yoga is real and often valuable, but it is a much later development. If you came here expecting stretches, you will find the poses treated honestly and briefly in their original role, preparing the body to sit still. The one idea at the center. If you remember nothing else from this book, remember the second sutra. Everything else is commentary on it. Yoga's chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the stilling of the fluctuations of the mind. 1.2. Let us take that apart, because it is the whole system in one line. Chitta is the mind stuff. The entire field of mental activity. Thoughts, memories, impressions, the sense of being a self. Vritti means a fluctuation, a whirl, a wave, the constant churning of mental events. Nirodha means restraint, settling. Patanjali is saying that the practice called yoga is the progressive settling of the mind's endless churning, until awareness can rest clear and undistorted, like the surface of a pond going still enough to see the bottom. Then comes the payoff, Sutra 1.3, Tadarastu Swarupe Vasthanam. Then the seer rests in its own true nature, 1.3. And the alternative 1.4, which describes the state most of us live in most of the time. Vritti Sarupyam Itaratra. Otherwise, we are identified with the fluctuations. 1.4. This is the diagnosis at the root of the entire book, and it is startlingly modern. Ordinarily, Patanjali says, we mistake the movements of the mind for ourselves. A wave of anger arises and we become angry. A story of failure runs and we are a failure. A craving appears and we are the craving, helplessly. The waves are so constant and so convincing that we never notice we are the water. Practice is the gradual work of settling the water enough to recognize the difference, to be able to watch a thought or feeling as an event passing through awareness rather than being swept off by it. Modern psychology gave this recognition a name, decentering, or in acceptance and commitment therapy, cognitive diffusion, the capacity to see a thought as a thought rather than as reality. It turns out to be one of the best supported active ingredients in the whole field of contemplative practice. A 2015 meta-analysis by Gyu and colleagues found that increases in mindfulness and reductions in repetitive negative thinking, rumination, and worry statistically mediate the benefits of mindfulness-based therapies. That is, they appear to be the mechanism by which those therapies work. Patanjali named the target in a single sentence, roughly 16 centuries earlier. Notice what the goal is not. It is not a blank mind, not the suppression of thought by force, not emotional numbness. Nirodha is not a war on thinking. It is the settling that comes when you stop feeding the churn, a quieting that lets thought become clear rather than compulsive. Beginners almost always misunderstand this and try to bludgeon the mind into silence, which only produces more waves. The correct attitude, which the whole method cultivates, is closer to allowing the water to settle than to forcing it. The five kinds of mental wave. Before prescribing the cure, Patanjali classifies the churning. In Sutras 1.5.1.11, he says the vrittis are of five kinds, and each can be either klishta, afflicted, causing suffering, or aklishta, unafflicted, serving clarity. Thought itself is not the enemy, unexamined. The five are right knowledge, pramana, accurate perception, inference, and reliable testimony, error, viparyaya, false knowledge, believing things that are not so, imagination or conceptualization, vikalpa, words and ideas with no corresponding reality, from useful abstraction to empty worry, sleep, nidra, the mental state whose content is absence, and memory, smriti, the retention of past experience. The practical value here is a kind of mental taxonomy. When you learn to watch your mind, it helps enormously to be able to ask of any mental event, which kind is this? Is this an accurate perception or an error I am about to act on? Is this a real problem or is this vikalpa, imagination dressed up as fact, a future that exists only as words in my head? A remarkable amount of human suffering is vikalpa mistaken for pramana. Catastrophes that never happen, insults never intended, entire relationships lived out in the imagination. Simply naming the category loosens its grip. The two wings, practice and non-attachment. How does the settling happen? Patanjali gives the method in two words in Sutras 1-12, 1-16, and they function like the two wings of a bird. You need both or you go in circles. The first is abhyasa, sustained, patient practice. Sutra 1.14 is one of the most quietly demanding lines in the text. Practice becomes firmly grounded only when it is done for a long time, without interruption, and with earnest devotion, not intensely for a week, steadily. This is the ancient version of what habit research now tells us. Consistency beats intensity, and durable change is measured in months and years, not days. The popular 66 days to form a habit figure comes from a single 2010 study by Lally and colleagues, whose actual finding was a median of 66 days with an enormous range of 18 to 254. The real lesson is that it takes longer and varies more than the tidy number suggests. The second wing is vairagya, non-attachment, or better, non-grasping. This is not indifference or cold detachment. It is the release of the compulsive need for things to be a certain way. It is the willingness to act fully while loosening your grip on the outcome. Where abhyasa is the effort to steady the mind, Vairagya is the letting go that keeps that effort from becoming just another form of grasping. Practice without non-attachment becomes striving and self-punishment. Non-attachment without practice becomes passivity and drift. This pairing has a direct modern echo. The entire framework of acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, is built on the same two wings under different names. Committed action toward your values, abhyasa, and acceptance of inner experience without struggling to control it. ACT is one of the best validated psychotherapies in existence. A 2015 meta-analysis of 39 randomized trials found substantial benefit, and a later review across 103 trials found it effective for anxiety, depression, chronic pain, and addiction, roughly on par with cognitive behavioral therapy. That a 21st century evidence-based therapy independently rediscovered Patanjali's two wings is one of the more striking convergences in this book. The whole map, the eight limbs. Patanjali's most famous contribution is the Ashtanga eight-limbed path laid out in the second book. It is the scaffold for all the practical chapters that follow, so it is worth seeing whole before we take it apart. Note the word is limbs, not steps. Like the limbs of a body, they develop together and support one another, even though there is a rough order of emphasis. Yama, restraints, how you treat the world, non-harming, truthfulness, non-stealing, moderation, non-grasping. Two niyamat, observances, how you treat yourself, cleanliness, contentment, disciplined effort, self-study, and surrender. Three. Usa, steady, comfortable posture, the body made a reliable base. Four. Pranayama, regulation of the breath, and through it of arousal and attention. Five. Pratyahara, withdrawing attention from the pull of the senses, turning inward. Six. Dharana, concentration, holding attention on one thing. Meditation, sustained, effortless flow of attention. 8. Samadhi, absorption, the collapse of the gap between attention and its object. There is a logic to the sequence. The first two limbs, yama and niyama, put your outer and inner life in enough order that the mind is not constantly agitated by its own mess. You cannot concentrate deeply while consumed by guilt, resentment, or chaos. The next three, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, settle the body, the breath, and the senses, the physical and physiological conditions for a quiet mind. The last three, dharana, dhyana, samadhi, are the meditative core, and Patanjali treats them almost as one continuous process, giving it a special name, Samyama, in the third book. A useful way to hold the map, the first five limbs prepare the mind. The last three train it directly. Most people who cannot meditate have simply skipped the preparation and are trying to concentrate a mind that their life, body, and breath are keeping agitated. This book takes the preparation seriously because Patanjali did. The rest of the manual walks these limbs one at a time in practical detail. But first, a short, honest tour of all four books, so you can see the whole terrain the limbs sit within. Part 2, the four chapters. Honestly, this part is a brief walk through all four books of the Yoga Sutras, so that you have the complete terrain in view. If you are eager to start practicing, you can skip ahead to part 3 and return here later. Nothing practical depends on reading it first. But most people find the practice makes more sense once they can see the whole arc it belongs to. Book 1, Samadhipada, the goal and the deep states. The first book, 51 Sutras, defines what yoga is and describes its highest reaches. We have already met its opening lines. The definition of yoga as the stilling of the mind's fluctuations, the classification of those fluctuations, and the two wings of practice and non-attachment. The rest of the book does two things. First, it offers a menu of methods for steadying the mind, and its generosity is worth noticing. Patanjali is not dogmatic about technique. He suggests that the mind can be settled by cultivating friendliness toward the happy, compassion toward the suffering, gladness toward the virtuous and equanimity toward the wicked. Sutra 1.33, a single verse that is as good a prescription for emotional health as any in the book, and the direct ancestor of modern loving-kindness meditation. He also suggests steadying the mind through breath regulation, 1.34, through focusing on a luminous inner steadiness, 1.36, through contemplating anything that settles you, 1.39. In other words, use what works. This is a permission slip. There is no single correct object of meditation, and you are allowed to find the one that quiets your mind. Second, the book describes samadhi itself, the state of deep absorption, and distinguishes its levels. For a beginner, these distinctions are mostly a distant map. You do not need to chart the Himalayas to take a good walk. But because this manual promises to cover the whole territory, here is the map in brief, and it is worth reading once, even if you will not need it for years. Patanjali divides absorption into two great classes. The first is Samprajnata Samadhi, cognitive absorption, still resting on an object, 1.17. It has four progressively subtler supports which drop away one by one as concentration deepens. Vitarka, absorption on a gross object, still mixed with reasoning. Vichara, on a subtle object with fine reflection. Ananda, accompanied by bliss. And Asmita, accompanied only by the bare sense of. The mechanism by which the settled mind fuses with its object is called Samapati or engrossment, 1.41. The still mind, Patanjali says, becomes like a flawless crystal that takes on the exact color of whatever rests on it until the knower, the knowing, and the known coincide. On a gross object, this ripens from Savitarka, still colored by the object's name and concept, into Nirvitarka, where the name and idea fall away and the object shines alone, 1.43. On a subtle object, from Savichara into Nirvichara, 1.44. All of these still rest on an object that leaves a residual seed, so Patanjali calls them Sabija, or with seed, Samadhi, 1.46. Beyond them lies the second great class, Asamprajnata Samadhi, non-cognitive or objectless absorption, 1.18, reached by repeatedly practicing the release of even the object itself, until only latent impressions remain. When those final impressions too are stilled, what is left is Nirbija or seedless Samadhi, 1.51. Absorption with no object and no seed for future mental activity. This seedless state is the doorway toward liberation described in Book 4. What matters practically for now is the recognition that concentration has enormous depth, that attention can become far more collected and stable than ordinary life ever demands, and that this deepening is. If the Sanskrit is a lot to hold, here is the whole ladder at a glance, from the ordinary mind at the bottom to the deepest absorption at the top. You climb this ladder from the bottom, one rung at a time, and almost all real practice happens on the lowest two rungs. The higher ones are simply the same road continuing. Book 2, Sadhana Pada, The Practical Path, the second book, 55 Sutras, is the engine room of the text and the source of most of this manual. It opens with Kriya Yoga, the yoga of action, a compact three-part practice of disciplined effort, tapas, self-study, swadhyaya, and surrender, Ishvara Pranidhana. Then it presents the diagnosis that motivates the whole path, the kleshas, the five afflictions that distort the mind. The five kleshas. The roots of suffering, Patanjali's account of why we suffer, Sutras 2.3 to 2.9, is precise enough to serve as a working psychology. The five afflictions are avidya, ignorance, specifically the misperception of reality, mistaking the impermanent for the permanent, the impure for the pure, the painful for the pleasant, and the not self for the self. Patanjali calls this the root affliction, the soil. The other four grow from asmita, the collapse of awareness into a rigid, defended self-image. The confusion of the one who sees with the instruments of seeing, raga, attraction, clinging to pleasure and to what has pleased us before, dvesha, aversion, recoil from pain and from what has hurt us before, abhinivesha, the clinging to life, the deep instinctive fear of death and dissolution, which Patanjali notes runs even in the wise. What makes this list useful, rather than merely philosophical, is the mechanism. Almost every reactive, self-defeating thing a person does can be traced to raga and dvesha, chasing what we like, fleeing what we dislike, both resting on avidya, a distorted picture of what will actually make us happy. This is not far from what psychology finds when it studies the drivers of unhappiness, the constant approach and avoid machinery, the treadmill of craving, the experiential avoidance that ACT identifies as central to suffering. Patanjali's practical claim is that these afflictions can be thinned, first by clear seeing, then by meditation, until they no longer run you automatically. The book then presents the 8 limbs as the method for thinning them and describes the first 5 in enough detail to practice. Book 3, Vibhuti Pada, The Powers and How to Read Them. The third book, 56 Sutras, is where many modern readers get uncomfortable, and it is worth handling directly rather than pretending it is not there. Patanjali introduces Samyama, the combined practice of concentration, meditation and absorption directed at a single object, and then makes a long series of claims that by applying samyama to various objects, one gains extraordinary powers. Knowledge of past and future, understanding the speech of all creatures, knowledge of past lives, reading others' minds, invisibility, immense strength, even levitation, and the ability to enter another body. Before the powers, though, the book opens with a piece of genuine psychology that often gets overlooked. In Sutras 3.9 to 3.15, Patanjali analyzes how the mind actually changes over time through what he calls 3 transformations, parinama. There is the transformation towards stillness, as the habit of distraction is gradually replaced by moments of quiet, nirodha parinama. The transformation toward absorption, as the mind scatters, gives way to one-pointedness, samadhi parinama, and the transformation of one-pointedness itself as the same object holds attention moment after moment. The point for a practitioner is that change is not a switch you flip, but a slow shift in the ratio of settled moments to scattered ones. You do not banish distraction, you tilt the balance a little at a time until stillness becomes the mind's default. How should an honest, science-respecting reader handle this? A few ways, and you can hold more than one. You can read it psychologically and symbolically as a catalogue of the genuine refinements of a highly trained attention. Extraordinary sensory acuity, deep empathy that can feel like mind reading, vivid access to memory, a sense of time loosening in deep states. Many of these have modest real-world correlates, sustained attention training in intensive retreat settings measurably sharpens perception, for example. You can read it as a map of attachment traps. This is Patanjali's own framing. And it is the most important point. He does not celebrate the powers. In Sutra 3.38, he warns that these attainments are obstacles to the higher goal. The whole chapter is, in a sense, a warning. The deep states generate seductive experiences and abilities, and clinging to them, more raga, derails the practitioner from freedom. The practical lesson survives completely, even if you set every supernatural claim aside. Do not get seduced by the impressive byproducts of practice, the blissful states, the insights, the sense of specialness. And you can read it as a historical document describing the worldview of its time without needing to endorse or debunk its metaphysics. This book takes no position on whether levitation is possible. It takes a firm position that chasing it or its psychological equivalents misses the point. For a beginner, The entire practical content of Book 3 reduces to two things. The technique of Samyama, deep, unified attention on one object, covered in the chapters on the last three limbs, and the warning not to be captured by whatever that technique produces. 9. Book 4, Kaivalya Pada, Freedom. The fourth and final book, 34 Sutras, turns to Kaivalya, aloneness, or better liberation. The mind so clarified that awareness rests in its own nature, no longer entangled in and identified with its own contents. This is the destination named back in Sutra 1.3. Now examined more deeply, the book discusses the nature of mind, the way impressions drive future behavior, the workings of karma understood as the momentum of past action, and the final settling in which the fluctuations no longer distort the seer. Three of its ideas are worth drawing out, because they give the whole system its depth. The first is the psychology of habit, 4.7 to 4.11. Every experience deposits a faint subliminal trace, a samskara, recurring samskaras of the same kind pool into a vasana, a standing tendency, what we would call a character trait or a condition pattern, and these become the seedbed from which future actions and their consequences, karmas. This is the deep level counterpart to the two-tier work on the afflictions described later in this manual, chapter 18. Practice does not merely calm a reaction in the heat of the moment. Over years, it gradually stops laying down the very impressions that generate the reactions in the first place. Patanjali says, the mature practitioner's action becomes neither white nor black, no longer sowing new binding impressions, while ordinary reactive action keeps the wheel of tendency. The second idea is the nature of the mind itself, 4.80-4.19. And it is the philosophical backbone of this book's central image. The mind, citta, Patanjali argues, is itself an object, something known, and it is not self-luminous. It no more lights itself than an eye can see itself. What knows the mind is the changeless awareness behind it. This is exactly why the claim in part I, that you are the water and not the waves, is meant literally not just as a metaphor. What watches a thought is not another thought, but the steady seer of Sutra 1.3. Patanjali also pauses here to argue against the idealists of his day that the world is not merely a projection of your mind. The same object goes on existing whether or not anyone mind is attending to it, and it appears differently to different minds. So it cannot be the creation of a single one. Sutras 4.15 to 4.17. He wants a real seer resting in a real world, not a solipsist dream. The third idea is the culmination, Dharma Mega Samadhi, the cloud of virtue, 4.29, 4.30. When a practitioner established in unbroken discernment loses all craving, even for the highest meditative attainments, this final absorption rains down and exhausts the remaining afflictions and karma, opening into Kaivalya. Not annihilation, but the aloneness of pure awareness, resting in itself. For our purposes, the fourth book is best read as a horizon, rather than a to-do list. Very few people then or now reach what it describes, and the honest thing to say is that its ultimate claims about consciousness lie entirely outside what science can evaluate. But the direction it points is intelligible and valuable to anyone. A life progressively less driven by compulsion, less enslaved to craving and aversion, less identified with every passing storm of thought, and correspondingly freer, steadier, and more available to what is actually in front of you. You do not need to believe in final liberation to walk toward more freedom. That walk is the subject of the rest of this book. Part 3, The Eight Limbs in Practice. This is the working core of the manual. Each of the eight limbs is treated the same way, what Patanjali said, what it means in plain language, how to practice it, what the science says. Read the limbs in order the first time, because they build, once you know the territory, use this part as a reference you return to. A reminder on attitude, because it shapes everything. The point is not to become a rigid rule follower or to grade yourself. Patanjali's ethics are not commandments imposed from outside. They are described as the natural conduct of a mind becoming clear, and as conditions that make a clear mind possible, approach them as experiments in living. The right spirit is closer to a scientist's curiosity, what happens in my mind and life when I practice this, than to a student cramming for judgment. 10. Yama, how you treat the world. The first limb is yama, usually translated restraints or abstentions. These are five ways of relating to other people and the world that reduce the friction, guilt, and agitation that make a steady mind impossible. Patanjali's insight, and it is a deeply practical one, is that you cannot have a peaceful mind and a chaotic, harmful, dishonest life at the same time. The ethical limbs come first, not because yoga is moralistic, but because an untidy conscience is one of the loudest sources of mental noise. Try to meditate the evening after you have lied to someone you love, and you will understand why Patanjali. He also makes a striking claim in Sutra 2.31. The yamas, when practiced without exception, regardless of birth, place, time, or circumstance, constitute the great vow. The point is universality. An ethic that has convenient exceptions is not really an ethic. You need not achieve perfection, but the direction is meant to be unconditional. The five yamas are ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, and aparigraha. Nelly 10.1 ahimsa, non-harming. What Patanjali said, ahimsa is listed first, and the tradition treats it as the foundation the other four rest on. It means non-violence, non-harming, in thought, word, and deed. Sutra 2.35 makes a bold behavioral claim. When one is firmly established in non-harming, hostility ceases in one's presence. The person who has genuinely let go of inner violence stops provoking it in others. Plain meaning, ahimsa is not merely do not be violent, which most of us manage most days. It is the progressive removal of harm from the whole of your life, including the subtle harm of contempt, cruelty in speech, harshness toward yourself, and the low-grade aggression of impatience and blame. Crucially, ahimsa turns inward as much as outward. The harsh inner critic, the punishing self-talk, the war against your own body and feelings. These are all himsa, violence, and they agitate the mind exactly as external conflict does. How to practice it? Start with speech for 1 week. Watch your words for harm, sarcasm, contempt, cutting remarks, gossip that diminishes someone. You do not have to become bland. You have to notice the impulse to wound and, more often than not, decline it. When you catch harsh self-talk, I'm such an idiot, treat it as an instance of himsa and consciously substitute the tone you would use with a friend. This is not self-indulgence. See the science box. Widen the circle gradually. Ahimsa historically extends to how you treat animals and the living world. And many practitioners move toward a more plant-based, lower harm diet over time. Let this be an evolution, not a sudden purge that becomes its own kind of violence against yourself or through insufferable self-righteousness toward others. The pause, most harm is reactive. The single most effective ahimsa practice is inserting a breath between impulse and action. When you feel the flash of anger or contempt, one conscious exhale is often enough to keep you from doing the harmful thing. What the science says, self-compassion beats self-attack. Strong the inward face of ahimsa. Dropping harsh self-criticism is one of the best supported ideas here. Kristin Neff's research program on self-compassion shows it is strongly linked to well-being, a 2015 meta-analysis by Zessin et al. Across 79 samples, in approximately 16,400, found a correlation of about R approximate 0.47 and strongly inversely linked to depression, anxiety, and stress. Macbeth and Gumley, 2012-20 studies, are approximately minus 0.54. Self-compassion does not reduce motivation, the common fear. It motivates without the corrosive cause of self-criticism. Treating yourself less violently is not soft. It is effective. Moderate strong, the outward face, cultivating goodwill also holds up. Loving kindness meditation reliably increases positive emotions. Fredrickson et al. 2008. Later meta-analyses of 24 studies show a medium effect on positive effect. Is an influential 2013 claim, Koch et al. 2013, that this literally improves cardiac vagal tone, failed reanalysis, Heathers et al. 2015. Cultivating kindness reliably shifts how you feel. The specific physiological headline was overstated. How people get it wrong? They practice ferocious nonviolence toward everyone but themselves, turning ahimsa into another stick to beat themselves with. I got angry again. They also confuse ahimsa with passivity or being a doormat. But declining to harm is not the same as declining to act, set boundaries, or protect. Sometimes the least harmful thing overall is a firm no. Nech 10-2-2, Satya, truthfulness, what Patanjali said. Satya is truthfulness in thought, speech, and action. Sutra 2.36. When established in truth, one's words gain a kind of reliable potency. What one says tends to come true because there is no gap between speech and reality. Plain meaning, Satya is alignment between what is real, what you think, what you say, and what you do. It includes not lying to others, but it goes deeper to not lying to yourself, which is subtler and more consequential. Most of our suffering is downstream of small self-deceptions. The rationalization, the flattering story, the fear we refuse to name. Satya is the discipline of seeing and saying what is actually so. The tradition adds a vital qualification. Satya is always subordinate to ahimsa. Truth is not a license for cruelty. If a truth would harm without purpose, the yogic answer is usually silence. Not a comforting lie. You are not obliged to say everything true, but you are obliged not to say what is false. How to practice it? Stop the small lies. For a week, notice the automatic little falsehoods. I'm fine. I loved it. I'll definitely be there and either make them true or gently decline to say them. This is startlingly revealing about how often we lie to smooth things over. Name the thing you are avoiding. Once a day, ask, what am I not being honest with myself about right now? Write the answer down. You need not act on it immediately. Just stop hiding it from yourself. Truthful and kind. Before difficult honesty, run it through the ahimsa filter. Is this true? Is it necessary? And can I say it without cruelty? If yes to all three, say it. If it fails necessary or kind, reconsider. Close the say-do gap. Satya in action means your commitments and your behavior match under promise. Keep your word. Every kept small promise strengthens the mind's integrity. What the science says. Authenticity and honesty track well-being. Moderate goals pursued for authentic self-concordant reasons produce more sustained effort and greater well-being than goals adopted to please others or avoid guilt, Sheldon and Elliot, 1999, and a substantial follow-on literature. Living in line with your real values, with the say-do gap closed, is reliably associated with better mental health. Weak, a widely cited Science of Honesty study, Kelly and Wang, 2012, found that participants asked to reduce their lies over 10 weeks reported fewer health complaints and better relationships. But the study was small and relied on self-report, so treat it as suggestive, not settled. The broad principle, self-deception is costly, authenticity helps, is better supported than any single dramatic finding. How people get it wrong? They weaponize just being honest as permission for cruelty. The opposite of Patanjali's intent, since Satya serves ahimsa, not the reverse, or they confuse blunt oversharing with truthfulness. Satya is not compulsive disclosure, it is the refusal to falsify. 10.3 Astya, non-stealing, what Patanjali said. Astya is non-stealing. Sutra 237. When established in non-stealing, all wealth or all jewels comes to one. The person who does not grasp at what is not theirs paradoxically lacks nothing. Plain meaning. Obviously, this means not taking others' property, but the deep reading is about a mindset of taking rooted in a felt sense of lack. Astya includes not stealing others' time, chronic lateness, wasting people's hours, their credit, taking recognition you did not earn, their energy, relationships where you only take. Underneath theft is the belief I do not have enough and I must get more from outside. Astya works on that belief directly. How to practice it? Guard others' time. Be punctual. End meetings on time. Do not make people chase you. Time is the one non-renewable thing you can steal. And most of us do it casually. Give credit generously. Actively name others' contributions. Notice the impulse to absorb credit and reverse it. Take only your share. Notice small socially invisible takings. Padding an expense. The office supplies, the everyone does it liberties, and decline them, not from priggishness, but as training in a mind that does not operate from lack. When you feel the urge to take, pause and ask what lack you are trying to fill. Often the honest answer reframes the whole impulse. What the science says, the mindset of not enough undermines well-being. Moderate. The felt sense of lack that drives taking is closely tied to materialism, and materialism is reliably bad for well-being. A large 2014 meta-analysis, Dittmar et al., 2014, drawing on 259 independent samples and 753 effect sizes, found a consistent negative association between materialistic values and well-being, modest in size, around R, approximately -0.15 to -0.9, but consistent and stronger for compulsive acquisition. Astya's underlying claim that grasping from a sense of scarcity makes you worse off rather than better is well supported, even if the effect on any one person is gentle rather than dramatic. How people get it wrong? They read Astya narrowly, I am not a thief, and miss the everyday forms, stealing attention, time, credit, emotional labor. The practice lives in those subtle places. 10.10 for Brahmacharya, moderation and right use of energy, what Patanjali said. Brahmacharya Sutra 2.38. When established in it, one gains virya, meaning vigor, vitality, energy. In classical monastic context, the word meant, but its literal sense is, moving in Brahman, conduct that keeps you oriented toward the higher, and its functional meaning is the wise regulation of your vital energies, especially sexual energy, but by extension all appetite and stimulation. Plain meaning. For a modern layperson who is not a monk, Brahmacharya is best understood as moderation and non-dissipation. Meaning you do not squander your finite energy and attention on compulsive stimulation. It is the discipline of not letting appetite, sexual, but also the appetite for novelty, intensity, distraction, run you ragged and leave you scattered. In an age of infinite on-demand stimulation, this may be the most immediately relevant yama of all. The modern equivalent of dissipated virya is the fragmented attention and dulled sensitivity that follow hours of compulsive scrolling, binging, and stimulation seeking. How to practice it? Identify your dissipations. Honestly name the behaviors that leave you depleted and scattered rather than nourished, which differs by person. Common ones: compulsive phone use, pornography, doom scrolling, endless streaming, stimulation you reach for out of boredom or avoidance. Introduce friction. You rarely need to eliminate. You need to make the compulsive version harder and the conscious version possible. Remove apps from the home screen. keep the phone out of the bedroom, set a stop time for screens, sensory fast. Periodically, take a defined break from a source of overstimulation. A day without social media, an evening without screens. Notice how sensory sensitivity and steadiness return, channel. Do not just suppress. Brahmacharya is about directing energy, not white knuckling against it. Put the reclaimed energy and attention into practice, work, relationships, creation. What the science says, this maps onto sense withdrawal, see LIM5, and attention. The specific claims of Brahmacharya, for example, that celibacy confers vitality, are not well studied and should not be overstated. But the general principle that compulsive overstimulation fragments attention and that deliberate moderation restores it connects to real findings on attention, regulation, and habit discussed under Pratyahara, chapter 14. Frame Brahmacharya practically as stimulation hygiene and it becomes one of the most useful and testable practices in the book. How people get it wrong? They turn it into shame-driven repression, which tends to backfire. The suppressed appetite rebounds harder. Brahmacharya done well feels like reclaimed energy and sharper aliveness. If your practice of it is producing self-loathing, you are doing himsa, not Brahmacharya. 10.5 Aparigraha, non-grasping what Patanjali said. Aparigraha is non-possessiveness, non-hoarding, non-grasping. Sutra 2.39 makes an intriguing claim. When established in non-grasping, one gains knowledge of the why and how of existence. Freedom from clinging opens a clearer view of life, including, the tradition says, insight into one's own births. Plain meaning. Aparigraha is the release of the compulsion to acquire and cling to possessions, to people, to identities, to outcomes, to being right. It is vairagya, non-attachment, one of the two wings applied to the material and relational world. Where asteya is about not taking what is not yours, aparigraha is about not clinging to what is, holding your possessions, relationships, and even your self-image with an open hand. It is the antidote to the exhausting project of accumulation that never delivers the security it promises. How to practice it? Own less deliberately, periodically, let things go. The felt experience of giving away what you were clinging to and surviving, even feeling lighter, retrains the grasping mind directly. Hold outcomes loosely, do your work fully, release your grip on the result. This is aparigraha applied to effort, and it is the practical heart of acting without attachment to the fruits. Notice identity clinging. We grasp at self-images, I am the successful one, I am the victim, as fiercely as at possessions. When you feel defensive, ask what self-image you are protecting and whether you could hold it more loosely enough. Cultivate the sense of enough with money, with things, with achievement. Define what enough is in advance so the goalposts stop moving. What the science says, grasping, strong concept, aparigraha targets what psychology calls hedonic adaptation, the well-documented tendency to return to a baseline level of satisfaction after acquisitions and improvements, so that the new car, house or salary delivers a spike of pleasure that fades, leaving you reaching for the next. The grasping mind is the vivid early lottery winner study, Brickman et al., 1978, had just 22 winners, a tiny sample, weaker than its fame implies. But the broader adaptation finding is solid. Combined with the materialism and well-being evidence noted under asteya, the case for holding things loosely is strong. Aparigraha's positive counterpart, contentment, is covered under the Niyama Santosha, chapter 11. How people get it wrong? They confuse aparigraha with enforced poverty or neglecting responsibilities. It is not about having nothing. It is about not being had by what you have. A person can be wealthy and non-grasping, or poor and consumed by craving. 11 Niyama, how you treat yourself. The second limb, Niyama, turns from the world to the self. If the Yamas are about not creating outer friction, the Niyamas are about actively cultivating the inner conditions for a clear mind. There are five: Socha, Santosha, Tapas, Swadhyaya, and Ishvara Pranidhana. The last three are the same three that open book 2 as Kriya Yoga, and Patanjali evidently considered them the practical heart of self-transformation. 11.1 Saucha, cleanliness and clarity. What Patanjali said, Saucha is purity or cleanliness of body and mind. Patanjali gives it two sutras. Sutra 240, from cleanliness of the body arises a certain disinterest in one's own body and a disinclination to contact with others, which is often read as a maturing beyond bodily obsession. Sutra 2.41 is the more useful one. From mental purity, sattva, come cheerfulness, one-pointedness, mastery of the senses, and fitness for self-realization. Plain meaning, Socha is keeping your body, your environment, and your mind clean enough to function clearly. Outer cleanliness, meaning hygiene, and an orderly space is the obvious layer. The deeper practice is mental cleanliness. Not letting the mind fill with clutter, resentment, and low-grade contamination. A cluttered room and a cluttered mind reinforce each other, and so do a clean body, a clean space. How to practice it? Body, basic hygiene, but done consciously. Treat washing, grooming, and caring for the body as a small daily practice rather than an autopilot chore. Environment. Keep your primary spaces, especially where you sleep and where you practice, uncluttered. A tidy space measurably lowers the friction to a settled mind. Diet as Socha. Many practitioners extend Socha to what they put in the body. Cleaner, simpler, less processed food. Do this sensibly and without turning it into anxious perfectionism, which would be its own mental impurity. Mental hygiene. This is the core. Do not marinate in resentment, envy, or contempt. Notice when the mind is collecting dirt and consciously clear it through the emotional practices of 1.33, friendliness, compassion, gladness, equanimity, through honest journaling. Media diet. In the modern context, Socha includes what you feed your mind through screens, consuming a stream of outrage, comparison, and noise is a failure of mental cleanliness with direct effects on mood. What the science says, environment and the limits of purity. The claim that a clean external environment supports focus and lower stress is reasonable and consistent with everyday evidence, though it is not the subject of dramatic trials. Be cautious, though, with purity framings around food and body. Taken to extremes, they can shade into orthorexia, an unhealthy fixation on clean eating, and body shame, which are forms of mental impurity and self-himsa, exactly what Socha is meant to reduce. The healthy version of Socha is clarity and care, not anxious perfectionism. How people get it wrong? They fixate on external and dietary purity while ignoring the mental cleanliness. Patanjali actually emphasizes. He gives the mental result, cheerfulness and one-pointedness. A person can eat an immaculate diet and have a mind full of contempt, and that is not Socha. 11.2 Santosha, contentment, what Patanjali said. Santosha is contentment. Sutra 242 is one of the most quietly radical lines in the text. From contentment, unsurpassed happiness is gained. Not from getting what you want, but from plain meaning. Santosha is the practice of being at peace with what is right now, without needing circumstances to change first. This is the positive counterpart to aparigraha, non-grasping, where aparigraha releases the reaching, Santosha rests in the sufficiency of the present. It is emphatically not passivity or complacency. You can be deeply content and still work to change things. The difference is that your peace no longer depends on the outcome. Contentment is the ground you act from, not a reward you receive after. How to practice it? The gratitude practice. Once a day, many people do it at night. Name three specific things from the day you are glad of. Specific beats, generic, the light through the kitchen window at breakfast. This is the single most tested contentment practice. See the science box. This is enough moments. Several times a day, pause and deliberately register sufficiency. Right now, in this moment, I have what I need. Most suffering is about a feared future or regretted past. Santosha is the repeated return to the adequacy of now. Cap, the comparison. Comparison is the great thief of contentment, and modern life is an engine of it. Notice when you are measuring your life against others, especially online, and gently disengage. Periodically turn attention to something you already possess and would miss if it were gone. Your health, a relationship, a skill, and let yourself actually appreciate it as if newly given. What the science says, contentment is trainable and the effect is real. Moderate, strong gratitude interventions are among the best tested well-being practices. Emmons and McCullough's foundational 2003 studies showed that weekly counting blessings raised well-being, optimism, and even sleep and exercise relative to controls, and the finding has replicated broadly. Effects are modest but real. Do not expect transformation from a week of it, but a sustained practice reliably nudges the baseline up. Strong. The deep rationale is hedonic adaptation. Because we adapt to improvements in circumstance, chasing satisfaction through acquisition largely fails. While practices that cultivate appreciation of what is already present work with the mind's tendencies instead of against them. One honest caveat about a popular claim. The widely repeated 40% of happiness is within your control figure from Lyubomirsky's Happiness Spy does not survive scrutiny. Brown and Rohrer, 2019. The underlying point still stands, though, that intentional practices like gratitude meaningfully affect how people get it wrong. They fear that contentment means giving up ambition or accepting the unacceptable. Patanjali's own life map refutes this. He pairs santosha, contentment, with tapas, fierce, disciplined effort in the very same list. The mature position is contented effort, working wholeheartedly for change from a place of inner peace, rather than from the driven anxiety of insufficiency. 11.3 Tapas. What Patanjali said, tapas literally means heat, the fire of disciplined effort, the willingness to endure difficulty for the sake of transformation. Sutra 2.43. Through tapas, impurities are burned away and the body and senses are perfected. It is one leg of Kriya Yoga. Plain meaning, tapas is the capacity to do the hard, unglamorous, repeated thing, to choose the difficult right action over the easy, comfortable one, and to keep choosing it. It is voluntary discomfort accepted for the sake of growth. The cold morning practice done anyway, the discipline maintained when motivation is gone, the friction that forges every worthwhile practice in this book requires tapas, because all of them are easy to start and hard to sustain. Tapas is the abhyasa wing, sustained practice made personal. How to practice it? Choose one keystone discipline. Do not try to forge everything at once. Pick a single daily practice, sitting for 10 minutes, a cold shower, an early wake, a device curfew. The unconditional quality is the point. Exceptions are where discipline leaks away. Voluntary discomfort, small doses. Periodically choose minor hardship on purpose. The cold end of the shower, the flight of stairs, the meal skipped, the hard conversation had. This trains the mind to stop fleeing every discomfort, which is devesha, aversion, eklesha. Skip the fasting variants. If you have diabetes or take glucose-lowering medication, a history of disordered eating, or are pregnant. The point is voluntary discomfort, not risk. Show up regardless of feeling. The core skill of tapas is decoupling action from mood. You do the practice because it is time to, not because you feel like it. Motivation is a fair weather friend. Tapas is the discipline that operates in its absence. Rest is not the enemy of tapas. True tapas is sustainable heat, not self-immolation. Burnout is a failure of tapas. What the science says, discipline, habit, and the trap of harshness. Strong trait self-control reliably predicts good life outcomes. Grades, health, finances, relationships, Derrida et al., 2012. Meta-analysis of 100 studies. The capacity tapas trains is genuinely valuable. Moderate durable behavior change takes longer than people expect. The well-known Lally et al. 2010 study found automaticity forming over a median of 66 days, ranging from 18 to 254 consistency over months, exactly as Abhyasa 1.14 inches. Important correction. Beware conflating tapas with harsh self-punishment. The research on self-compassion, see Ahimsa, shows that a kind but firm stance sustains effort better than self-criticism, which tends to trigger avoidance and collapse. And the popular idea of grit as a special predictor of success is weak. A 2017 meta-analysis, Crede et al., 2017, 67,000 people, found grit predicts performance only weakly and is largely just conscientiousness rebranded. Overall, grit correlates about 0.84 with plain conscientiousness. Translation: steady, self-compassionate consistency, not dramatic punishing willpower, is what actually works. Tapas is a warm fire, not a bonfire you throw yourself onto. How people get it wrong. They mistake tapas for self-punishment, drama or overreach, then burn out, confirming their belief that they have no discipline. Real tapas is closer to the quiet, unglamorous reliability of showing up daily than to heroic feats of will. 11.4 Swadhyaya. What Patanjali said, Swadhyaya means self-study. Both the study of sacred or wisdom texts and the study of oneself. Sutra 244. Through self-study, one comes into contact with one's chosen ideal or deepest nature. It is the second leg of Kriya Yoga. Plain meaning, Swadhyaya is the deliberate project of knowing yourself, your patterns, your reactions, your conditioning, your recurring stories, combined with steeping yourself in wisdom that illuminates the human condition, turning the light of attention onto your own mind to see how it actually operates, so that its automatic patterns become visible and therefore changeable. You cannot free yourself from what you cannot see. How to practice it? Journaling as inquiry. Regularly write, not to record events, but to examine your reactions. Why did that land so hard? What was I really defending? Over time, journaling reveals the recurring loops, the same fear, the same trigger, the same story that run your life beneath awareness. Study wisdom slowly. Read the suttas themselves and other durable wisdom literature, a little at a time. The point is not to accumulate information, but to have your own life reflected back and clarified. Track your kleshas. Using Patanjali's own map, chapter 7, notice which afflictions run you most. Is your life mostly driven by raga, craving, devesha, aversion, asmita, ego defense? Naming your dominant patterns is high-yield self-knowledge. Seek honest reflection. Others see our patterns more clearly than we do. Swadhyaya includes the humility to ask for and actually hear what the science says, knowing your values and the meaning it yields. Moderate strong, the self-examining. Values clarifying core of Swadhyaya connects to solid findings. Clarifying and affirming your core values buffers stress. The Self-Affirmation Literature, Cohen and Sherman, 2014 review. And a life oriented by a clear sense of meaning and purpose. The fruit Swadhyaya aims at is associated with substantially better outcomes, including lower mortality. Hill and Turiano, 2014, following over 6,000 adults for 14 years, found higher sense of purpose, predicted a significantly lower risk of death, independent of other factors. Self-knowledge that issues in a clearer sense of what matters is not a soft benefit. It tracks how long and how well people live. How people get it wrong? They turn self-study into self-obsession or endless rumination, circling the same wounds without insight or change. Swadhyaya is inquiry aimed at freedom, not brooding. If your self-examination consistently leaves you more stuck and more self-critical, it has curdled into rumination, a known risk factor for depression, and the corrective is the decentering practice at the heart of meditation, watching the patterns rather than drowning in them. 11.5 Ishvara Pranidhana, surrender. What Patanjali said, Ishvara Pranidhana is usually translated surrender to God or devotion to the Lord. Sutra 245, through surrender, samadhi, deep absorption is attained. It is the third leg of Kriya Yoga, and Patanjali offers it in Book 1 as a direct, even complete path in its own right. 1.3. Patanjali's Ishvara is a distinctive, somewhat abstract special self, untouched by affliction, not necessarily the personal god of any particular religion. Plain meaning. This is the limb most bound up with religious language, and you should take from it whatever fits your worldview honestly. Ishvara Pranidhana is fundamentally the release of the illusion of total control. The humble recognition that you are not the sole author of outcomes, and the willingness to give yourself over to something larger than your own ego and its agenda. For a theist, that larger something is God. For others, it can be truth, reality, life itself, the whole of which you are a part, or simply the way things are. The functional practice is the same, doing your part wholeheartedly and then letting go, surrendering the grip of the anxious, controlling ego that believes everything depends on it. How to practice it? Act, then release. Do your work as well as you can, then consciously hand over the outcome to God, to life, to the process, to whatever honestly holds meaning for you. This is the felt practice of not the doer, full effort, released grip. Many find it powerful to close the day by mentally offering it up, the wins, the failures, the unfinished, and letting the need to control tomorrow dissolve before sleep. Meet the uncontrollable with acceptance. When you hit something genuinely beyond your control, illness, loss, another person's choices, practice active acceptance rather than futile resistance. This is surrender in its most testable form. Choose your larger than me. If religious language does not fit you, do not force it, but do not skip the limb either. Identify honestly what you can orient toward beyond your own ego, the well-being of others, a body of truth, the natural world, a cause, and practice serving it rather than yourself. What the science says, letting go of what you cannot control. Moderate, stripped of metaphysics, Ishvara Pranidhana is the psychology of adaptive surrender, and here the evidence is real. Intolerance of uncertainty is a well-established risk factor for anxiety and worry. The capacity to tolerate the uncontrollable is protective. Research on control shows that while a general sense of agency is healthy, rigidly trying to control outcomes that are genuinely beyond you produces distress, and that secondary control, adjusting yourself to accept what cannot be changed, improves adjustment, Morling and Evard, 2006, and the broader coping literature. ACT's entire model of acceptance, dropping the struggle against inner experience and uncontrollable reality, is one of the best validated therapeutic principles going. The consistent fighting reality you cannot change makes you worse, while accepting it frees energy for what you can. The specifically religious claim that surrender to God brings the deeper states lies outside what science can test, and this book leaves it respectfully open. How people get it wrong. They hear surrender as fatalism or passivity, an excuse to stop trying. But in Patanjali's scheme, surrender sits alongside tapas, fierce effort, and swadhyaya, rigorous self-study. The formula is not give up. It is try fully, then release your grip on the result. Surrender is what you do with the part that was never yours to control in the first place. 12. Asana. A steady, comfortable seat. What Patanjali said. Here is one of the great surprises of the text. Patanjali devotes exactly 3 sutras to asana and never names a single pose. Sutra 2.46, Sthira Sukham Asanam. Posture should be steady and comfortable. Sutra 2.47, it is mastered by relaxing effort and letting the mind rest on the infinite. Sutra 248, then one is no longer disturbed by the pairs of opposites, heat and cold, and so on. That is the entire teaching on posture. Plain meaning. For Patanjali, asana means a seat, literally a way of positioning the body that is stable enough and comfortable enough that it stops being a distraction, so the mind can turn to meditation. The whole global world of postural yoga, the hundreds of poses, the flows, the studios grew up much later, largely in the last century or two, blending older Hatha yoga traditions with modern physical culture. It is real and often genuinely beneficial, but it is not what Patanjali is describing. His asana comes down to this: find a position you can hold, still and at ease. Those two words carry the whole instruction, and they are in productive tension. Sthira means steady, alert, stable, not slumping into sleep. Sukha means comfortable, at ease, pleasant, not gritted teeth endurance. The seat you want is both upright and alert and relaxed and sustainable. Most beginners err toward one or the other, rigidly straining or comfortably collapsing. The skill is the marriage of the two. How to practice it? The meditation seat, choose a position you can actually hold. You do not need a cross-legged lotus. Sitting on a firm chair with feet flat on the floor, sitting on a cushion cross-legged, kneeling with a cushion or bench, even lying down if you will not fall asleep. The best posture is the one you can keep still and at ease in for your whole sit. Build the seat from the ground up. Base grounded and stable, spine naturally upright, following its gentle curves, tall but not stiff, lifted from the crown, shoulders relaxed down, hands resting easily, chin very slightly tucked so the neck is long, face, jaw and belly soft. Apply 2.47, relax the effort. Once you are upright, actively let go of every bit of holding that is not needed to stay up. Scan for gripping in the shoulders, jaw, hands, belly and release it. The posture should hold you with minimal muscular fight. If you also do physical yoga, treat it in its supporting role. It prepares the body to sit, building the hip, back and shoulder ease that lets you be still without pain. Practice this way. Postural yoga is preparation for meditation, which is exactly asana's original job. On physical yoga, since most readers will do some, what the science says, postural yoga is legitimate, low-risk exercise, moderate for chronic low back pain. Yoga produces small to moderate improvements in function and pain versus non-exercise controls, but is about equal to other exercise. Cochrane Review, Wieland et al., 2017. Moderate yoga modestly lowers blood pressure. Roughly 5/4 millimeters of mercury in meta-analysis, Wu et al., 2019, and most when breathing and meditation are included. Solid but unsurprising, it reliably improves flexibility, balance and strength as any comparable physical training would. Weak moderate, it has small anti-anxiety and antidepressive effects. But trials are heterogeneous with weak controls. The honest summary, yoga is a genuine, safe, worthwhile form of movement with real but ordinary benefits. Claims that it is uniquely superior to other exercise are not supported. Do it because you enjoy it and it prepares body and mind. How people get it wrong? Two ways. Modern practitioners often think asana is yoga and never get to the other seven limbs, mistaking the antechamber for the house. And meditators often neglect the body entirely, then wonder why sitting is agony. Some basic physical preparation and a well-built seat prevent most of the knee and back pain that derails beginners. 13. Pranayama. Regulating the breath. What Patanjali said, after the seat is steady comes pranayama, regulation of the breath. Prana is the vital life energy carried by the breath. Ayama means extension or regulation. Sutra 249. Once posture is achieved, pranayama is the regulation of the movement of inhalation and exhalation. Sutras 2.50-2.51 describe controlling the breath's location, duration, and number, making it long and subtle, and a fourth state that transcends the inhale-exhale distinction. Sutra 2.52. As a result, the veil over the inner light is thinned. Sutra 2.53. And the mind becomes fit for concentration. Plain meaning. The breath is the one autonomic function you can easily take conscious control of, and in doing so, you gain a lever on your entire nervous system. Patanjali understood functionally what physiology now explains mechanistically. By regulating the breath, you regulate the mind and the body's state of arousal. Slow, controlled breathing is a direct, physical, reliable way to shift out of stress arousal and into calm, and over time to steady the mind enough for concentration. Of all eight limbs, pranayama has some of the clearest and strongest modern scientific support. Here is the core physiology, because understanding it makes the practice more effective. Your heart rate rises slightly when you inhale and falls when you exhale. When you breathe slowly, around 5 to 6 breaths per minute, this rhythm synchronizes with a natural 10-second oscillation in your cardiovascular system, the baroreflex, and the two resonate, amplifying heart rate variability and shifting your autonomic balance toward the calming parasympathetic rest and digest branch, largely via the vagus nerve. Emphasizing a long exhale deepens this effect, because the exhale is the vagally driven heart rate slowing phase of the breath. This is not mysticism. It is a well-characterized reflex you can drive on purpose. How to practice it? Start here safely. The foundational practice, the safest and best supported, is simply slow breathing with a long exhale. Resonance breathing, 6 breaths per minute. Breathe in gently through the nose for about 4 seconds, out for about 6 seconds. That is a 10-second cycle, 6 breaths. Keep it smooth and unforced. No straining, no gasping. Do this for 5 to 10 minutes. This single practice is the highest evidence, lowest risk breathing technique in the book. Use it daily and also as a reset whenever you notice stress. Cyclic sighing if you want the most tested mood lift. 2 inhales through the nose, a normal inhale, then a second short sip to fully fill the lungs, followed by a long, slow, complete exhale through the mouth. Repeat for about 5 minutes. In a 2023 Stanford randomized trial, this pattern outperformed both box breathing and mindfulness meditation for improving daily mood and lowering anxiety. Balban et al., 2023. Coherent nasal breathing as a default. Outside of formal practice, favoring slow, nasal diaphragmatic breathing, belly expanding on the inhale, as your resting default carries much of the benefit. Nasal breathing also releases nitric oxide from the sinuses, a mild vasodilator, though its practical effect on oxygenation is small. Gentle equal breathing, samavritti, inhale and exhale for an equal comfortable count, for example, 4 and 4, building steadiness. A calm, accessible entry point. More advanced techniques with real cautions. Traditional pranayama includes forceful and breath-holding techniques, kapalabhati, skull shining, rapid forced exhalations, bhastrika, the bellows breath, extended kumbhaka, breath retention. These have their place in supervised practice, but they carry genuine risk and their specific benefits are far less proven than slow breathings. Read the safety box before going near them. What the science says. Slow breathing is one of the best supported practices in this book. Strong, slowing the breath to 6 per minute reliably raises heart rate variability and baroreflex sensitivity and shifts autonomic balance toward the calming parasympathetic branch, a reliable, replicated physiological effect. Zaccaro et al., 2018, Systematic Review, Lehrer's HRV Biofeedback Research Program, Bernardi's Classic Studies Converging on 6 Breaths per Minute. Strong landmark. A 2023 randomized trial, Balban et al., 2023, Cell Reports Medicine, 108 participants, found that 5 minutes a day of structured breathwork improved mood and reduced anxiety, with cyclic sighing, long exhale emphasized, producing the biggest gains, and beating mindfulness meditation for these short-term arousal effects. Moderate, slow breathing and yogic breathing programs show benefit for anxiety and depression across several trials, though many are small and unblinded. Real moderate extended exhalation and nasal breathing have sound physiological basis. Preliminary, speculative breath retention, Kumbhaka, transiently alters CO2 and O2 and may raise CO2 tolerance over time. But broad health claims are unproven and retention acutely raises blood pressure and sympathetic drive.
Safety, read before doing any forceful or breath holding technique. Never practice rapid hyperventilation breathing, Kapalabhati, Bhastrika, power breathing, Wim Hof style cyclic hyperventilation or breath holds in or near water.
Pre-hyperventilation can suppress the urge to breathe until you black out underwater, shallow water blackout, a recognized, sometimes fatal mechanism. Hyperventilation techniques can also cause dizziness, tingling, tetany, and fainting on dry land by blowing off carbon dioxide. Forceful breathing and prolonged retention are contraindicated in pregnancy, uncontrolled high blood pressure and cardiovascular disease, epilepsy or seizure disorders, recent stroke, aneurysm, glaucoma, and serious psychiatric conditions. If you have any significant medical condition, get clearance before advanced pranayama and learn forceful techniques from a qualified teacher, not a book or video. Slow, gentle, 6 breaths per minute breathing is low risk for almost everyone. Make it your foundation and treat everything more intense as optional. How people get it wrong. They chase dramatic, intense techniques because those feel like real practice or promise quick highs, while skipping the humble, slow breathing that has the strongest evidence. They also strain forcing the breath into rigid counts until it becomes stressful, which defeats the entire purpose. Pranayama done well is smooth, quiet, and comfortable. If you are gasping or lightheaded, Pratyahara. Turning the senses inward. What Patanjali said. The fifth limb, Pratyahara, is the bridge between the outer limbs and the inner ones. Sutra 254. Pratyahara is when the senses withdraw from their objects and, as it were, follow the mind inward rather than dragging it outward. Sutra 2.55. From this comes supreme mastery over the senses. Plain meaning. Ordinarily, the senses run the show. A notification chimes and your attention is gone. A smell, a sound, a flicker of movement, and the mind is yanked outward, helplessly. Pratyahara is the trainable capacity to unhook attention from sensory pull, to withdraw the senses from their objects, so that you, not your environment, direct your attention. Patanjali gives the perfect image. The senses withdrawing like a tortoise drawing in its limbs. This is the essential hinge of the whole path, because you cannot concentrate the next limb while your attention is being constantly kidnapped. Note how directly this addresses modern life. We live in the most sensorially aggressive environment in human history, an economy explicitly engineered to capture and sell your attention, delivering an endless stream of pings, feeds, and stimulation designed to keep the senses perpetually hooked. Pratyahara is the counter skill, and it may be the single most relevant limb for the 21st century. It is also where brahmacharya, moderation of stimulation, and pratyahara meet. The former reduces the input, the latter trains the capacity to unhook from it. How to practice it? Reduce the input. First, environmental pratyahara. Before training the inner skill, remove the hooks, silence notifications, keep the phone in another room during focused work and practice. Create low stimulation periods and spaces. This is the easy, high yield half, and it directly supports the harder inner work. Practice unhooking on purpose. In meditation, sensory pulls will arise, a sound, an itch, a craving to check the phone. The core pratyahara rep is to notice the pull, not act on it, and return attention inward. Each time you decline to follow a sensory impulse and come back, you strengthen the capacity. Meditation is, among other things, pratyahara training, the body scan. Deliberately moving attention slowly through the body, sensing each part from the inside, is a classic pratyahara and interoception practice. Attention turned inward toward internal sensation rather than outward toward the world. Periodically take defined breaks from a dominant sense stream. A day off social media, a silent morning, a walk with no earbuds. These reset an overstimulated system and make the return of the senses. Doing one thing at a time, with the senses gathered on that one thing, is pratyahara in daily life. Multitasking is the opposite, attention permanently fragmented across competing sensory demands. What the science says, attention can be trained inward. Be modest about the deeper claims. Moderate turning attention inward toward the body. Interoception is a real, studiable capacity centered on the insular cortex. Craig's Neuroanatomy, Farb et al., 2015, on interoception and contemplative practice. Body scan and mindfulness practices reliably increase self-reported interoceptive awareness. Weak mixed, an honest caveat. However, their effect on objective interoceptive accuracy, for example, measured heartbeat detection, is mostly null or inconsistent. So the felt sense of sharper inner awareness is real and useful. But claims of measurably superhuman inner sensing, the broader principle that deliberately withdrawing from overstimulation restores attentional control, is consistent with what is known about attention regulation, though pratyahara as such has not been isolated in trials. Frame it practically and testably. Reduce the hooks. How people get it wrong. They try to force the senses shut, straining to block out the world, which just creates more agitation. Pratyahara is not sensory deprivation or grim suppression. It is a gentle unhooking, letting the senses rest rather than fighting them. The tortoise withdraws its limbs calmly. It does not amputate them. Done well. Pratyahara feels like relief, the quiet of no longer being yanked around. The inner three, dharana, dhyana, samadhi, the last three limbs, concentration, meditation, and absorption, are the meditative core of the whole system. The destination the first five limbs were preparing you for. Patanjali treats them as three depths of a single continuous process rather than three separate techniques. And in book 3, he gives their combination a special name, Samyama, the tool he uses for everything in the powers chapter. They differ only in degree. How completely attention has unified with its object. The classic image is a stream of oil poured from one vessel to another. Dharana is repeatedly bringing the attention back to a chosen object. The drops of oil, individual, effortful, interrupted. Dhyana is when the attention flows to the object continuously, the oil pouring in an unbroken thread. Samadhi is when even the sense of a separate you attending to an object dissolves, and only the object remains, shining, with no felt gap between knower and known. You do not practice these separately. You practice concentration, and if it deepens and stabilizes, it becomes meditation. And if that deepens further, it becomes absorption. So the practical instruction for all three is really one instruction, and we will treat them together in depth, because this is where you will actually spend your sitting time. 15.1 Dharana. Concentration, what Patanjali said. Sutra 3.1 Desha Bandhas Chittasya Dharana. Concentration is the binding of the mind to a single place. That place can be a point in the body, an external object, the breath, a sound, an image, anything. The instruction is simply choose one object and hold the mind on it. Plain meaning, Dharana is focused attention, repeatedly, patiently returning the wandering mind to a single chosen anchor. This is where every meditator begins, and this is the single most important thing a beginner can hear. The returning is the practice. People believe meditation means keeping the mind fixed and blank. So when their mind wanders, which it will constantly, they conclude they are failing and quit. This is exactly backwards. The mind wandering and you noticing and gently bringing it back is not an interruption of the exercise. It is the repetition that builds the muscle. Every return is a rep. A session in which you noticed you had wandered 50 times and returned 50 times is a successful session. You did. How to practice a complete basic concentration meditation. 1. Take your seat. Chapter 12. Steady and comfortable, upright and relaxed. 2. Settle with the breath. A few slow breaths with long exhales. Chapter 13. To shift the nervous system toward calm. 3. Choose one anchor. For beginners, the breath is ideal. Specifically, the physical sensation of breathing at the nostrils, cool in, warm out, or the belly rising and falling. Alternatively, a repeated word or sound, mantra, a candle flame, a felt point in the body. Pick one and stay with it for the whole session. Rest attention on the anchor, not straining at it, resting on it. The way your eyes rest on something you are gently looking at. Feel each breath as fully and simply as you can. When the mind wanders, and it will, within seconds, over and over, notice that it has wandered, and gently return to the anchor. No judgment, no frustration, no story about failing, just, thinking back to the breath. The gentleness matters, returning with self-criticism trains agitation. 6. Repeat for the whole session. That is it. Notice, return. Notice, return. 10,000 times if needed. This is the entire practice and it is enough. How long, how often? Start small and be consistent. This is Abhyasa 1.14 and the science of habit agreeing. 5 to 10 minutes daily beats an hour once a week. Decisively build gradually 10 minutes for a few weeks, then 15, then 20. Same time each day, morning is traditional and practical, since the mind is quieter and the day has not hijacked you yet. Consistency over duration, always. 15.2 Dhyana, meditation. What Patanjali said, Sutra 3.2, Tatra Pratyaya Ekatanata Dhyanam. Meditation is the uninterrupted flow of attention toward that object. Dhyana is what Dharana becomes when the returns get shorter and rarer and attention begins to rest on the object continuously. Plain meaning, you do not do Dhyana as a separate technique. You arrive at it by staying with Dharana until the effortful, choppy returning smooths into a continuous, more effortless resting with. The gaps between distractions widen. The mind stops fighting and settles. There is still an object and still a sense of meditating, but the quality shifts from work to flow. Many sessions never reach it, and that is completely fine. The returning of Dharana is doing its work regardless. Dhyana comes as a byproduct of patient concentration. Trying to force it guarantees it will not come, because the forcing is itself agitation. Two great families of practice, the tradition and modern research, recognizes two broad styles, and it helps to know both. Focused attention, concentrative, what we have described, attention held on a single anchor, returning when it strays. This builds stability and calm. Open monitoring, choiceless awareness. Instead of fixing on one object, you rest in open awareness and simply watch whatever arises, thoughts, sensations, sounds, emotions, noting them without grabbing or pushing, letting each pass like clouds across the sky. This is the practice most directly aimed at Chitta Vritti Nirodha 1.2 and decentering. You learn to observe the mind's waves as events passing through awareness rather than being swept up in them. Patanjali's own emotional practice from 1.33, meeting experience with friendliness and equanimity. A common and effective structure. Begin with focused attention on the breath to gather and steady the mind, dharana. And once settled, open into monitoring, watching whatever arises with equanimity. Stability first, then openness. 15.3 Samadhi, absorption, what Patanjali said. Sutra 3.3. Samadhi is when, in meditation, the object alone shines forth and the mind's own form seems to vanish. The sense of a separate meditator drops away, leaving only the object luminous. Book 1 distinguishes gradations from absorption, still accompanied by subtle thought and self-reflection, samprajnata, towards states beyond even those. Plain meaning, samadhi is deep absorption, the collapse of the felt gap between the one who attends and the thing attended to. It is not a technique you perform, but a state that can arise when concentration becomes profoundly deep and stable. Most practitioners, especially beginners, will not reach the deep states Patanjali describes. And it is a mistake, a subtle form of raga, craving. The right relationship to samadhi is to practice concentration and meditation faithfully, and let whatever depth comes, come without grasping. Chasing special states is one of the most reliable ways to prevent them and to turn a peaceful practice into a striving, disappointed one. For the curious, this is where the stages mapped in Chapter 6 actually live. The absorptions that still rest on an object are samprajnata, with seed, samadhi, refining through vitarka, vichara, ananda, and asmita as the supports grow subtler. Beyond them lies the objectless, seedless, nirbija, absorption that shades toward the liberation of Book 4. You do not need any of these labels to practice, but it is worth knowing that they are the far end of the very same road that begins with simply resting attention on the breath. The path is continuous from your first 10-minute sit. There is also an important warning built into the text, and it applies to everyone. Deep practice can produce blissful, absorbing, even extraordinary experiences. And Patanjali explicitly warns in the Powers chapter 3.38 that clinging to these is an obstacle. Whatever arises in practice, bliss, insight, visions, a sense of specialness, is itself a wave to be met with the same non-grasping equanimity as everything else. The goal was never a special experience. What the science says, the strongest and the most oversold claims in the book live here. Strong modest, real benefits for mental health. The most rigorous benchmark, Goel et al.'s 2014 review in JAMA, Internal Medicine, 47 trials, 3,515 people, found meditation programs produce moderate evidence of small benefits for anxiety. Effect of 0.38 at 8 weeks, depression and pain. Effects around 0.3, with little sign they beat active alternatives like exercise or medication. For preventing depression, relapse specifically, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is well supported. Quicken et al., 2016, individual patient meta-analysis, 1,258 patients, relapse risk cut by about a third, hazard ratio, It is not a miracle, and it is roughly in the same league as other good interventions. Strong. The mechanism matches Patanjali. The best evidence way meditation helps is by reducing repetitive negative thinking and increasing decentering. Watching thoughts as passing events, Gyu et al. 2015, which is Chitta Vritti Nirodha 1.2, described in clinical language, moderate real effects on the brain and attention. Experienced meditators show reduced activity in the default mode network, the self-referential mind-wandering circuitry. During practice, Brewer et al. 2011. Focused practice trains attention networks, and intensive practice measurably sharpens sustained attention, McLean et al. 2010. Some structural brain differences appear in observational studies. Hulzel et al. 2011, Lazar et al. 2005, but with an important caveat below, overstated where popular culture runs past the data. Dramatic rewiring your brain claims outrun the evidence. Meta-analysis of structural change. Fox et al. 2014, Burnett et al. 2021, find real but medium effects drawn from small bias-prone, mostly observational samples. And tellingly, the best controlled randomized trials to date, Kral et al. 2022, two combined RCTs, N approximately 218, found no MBSR-induced structural brain change at all. That is a serious check on the enthusiasm. Cross-sectional differences between meditators and non-meditators may reflect who takes up meditation as much as what it does to the brain. Claims that meditation lengthens telomeres and reverses aging are the most oversold of all. The telomere evidence is, and benefits often shrink or vanish when compared against active control conditions rather than doing nothing. The reasonable stance, meditation delivers a calmer, more focused, less reactive mind and modest mental health benefit. Reliably treat anything grander with skepticism. Safety. Meditation is not risk-free for everyone. This is real and under discussed. In a 2021 study of people who had completed a mindfulness program, Britton et al. 2021, most reported at least one transient unpleasant experience, and a smaller share reported effects that genuinely lingered or interfered with daily life. Roughly 14% had a negative effect lasting at least a day, and about 6% had one that ran a month or longer. Detailed interview studies, Lindahl and Britton, 2017, catalog anxiety, fear, dissociation and depersonalization and perceptual and emotional distortions, especially with intensive, long, or high-dose practice and in people with a history of trauma. Build up gradually instead of diving into long retreats. Keep sessions moderate as a beginner, and if practice consistently stirs up distress, dissociation, or destabilizing states, ease off, find a qualified teacher, and if you have a significant mental health history, consider working with a professional who has experience with meditation-related difficulty. Meditation is a powerful intervention, and powerful interventions have side effects. How everyone gets these three wrong? One, believing a wandering mind means failure. No, the return is the practice. Two, straining to force calm or blankness, which manufactures agitation. Three, chasing special states and experiences, which is craving in disguise and blocks the very depth it seeks. And four, inconsistency, practicing intensely and sporadically instead of modestly and daily. Avoid these four, and you have avoided almost everything that stops people from benefiting. The practice is humble, patient, and cumulative. Sit down, rest attention on the anchor, return when you wander, and let the depth take care of itself over months and years. Part 4, Obstacles and Tools. Patanjali was a realist. He knew that anyone who tries to steady the mind will run into predictable resistance, and he named both the obstacles and the tools for working with them with remarkable precision. This part collects them. 16. The obstacles Patanjali named. In Sutras 1.30-1.31, Patanjali lists 9 antarayas, obstacles that scatter the mind and stall practice, along with their accompaniments. Reading the list is uncanny. It describes the exact ways practice falls apart then and now. The 9 obstacles are illness, a sick body disturbs the mind, dullness or apathy, mental heaviness, lack of drive, doubt, the corrosive, is this even working? Is this even real? Carelessness or haste, skipping the groundwork, rushing, laziness, physical and mental sloth, overindulgence, being pulled back into sense craving and dissipation, delusion or false views, misunderstanding the practice, failure to attain a footing, not reaching the next stage and getting discouraged, and instability, reaching a state but not being able to hold it. There are 4 companions. 1.31 are the symptoms of a scattered mind: mental distress, despair, trembling, or restlessness of the body. Why does this matter practically? Because when your practice stalls, and it will, you can usually locate which obstacle has you, and that turns a vague sense of failure into a solvable problem. Stalled by doubt, that is a known, named obstacle, not evidence, the path is fake, sunk in dullness. That is a recognized phase, often remedied by adjusting sleep, movement, or the time of day you practice, derailed by overindulgence and dissipation. Return to Brahmacharya and Pratyahara. Naming the obstacle is half of dissolving it. Patanjali's remedy for the whole cluster comes in the very next line. 132. One-pointed practice, steady application to a single practice, settles the scattered mind. The antidote to scatter is not more techniques, it is returning patiently to one. Pratipaksha Bhavana, cultivating the opposite. This is one of the most practical, immediately usable techniques in the entire text, and it is a cognitive reframing method some 1600 years ahead of its time. Sutra 233, when disturbed by negative thoughts. Sutra 2.34 adds the reasoning. Negative thoughts, like the impulse to harm, whether done, caused, or condoned, whether driven by greed, anger, or delusion, whether mild or intense, result in endless suffering and ignorance. Therefore, cultivate the opposite. The practice when you notice the mind gripped by a harmful or agitating pattern, resentment, craving, fear, contempt, self-attack, you deliberately generate and dwell on its counter. Not by suppressing the negative thought, which tends to amplify it, but by actively cultivating the opposite thought, feeling, or perspective. Concretely, caught in resentment towards someone, deliberately call to mind their difficulties, their humanity, a time they were kind, and cultivate understanding as the counter to hostility. This is the emotional practice of 1.33 applied. Gripped by a craving, cultivate the opposite by vividly recalling the emptiness that followed the last time you gave in, and the freedom of not being ruled by it, sunk in a story of catastrophe. Recognize it as vikalpa, imagination mistaken for fact, from 1.9, and deliberately construct the realistic or even favorable case with equal vividness. Attacked by the inner critic, cultivate the opposite, the compassionate, accurate voice you would use with a friend. What the science says, this is cognitive reappraisal. Strong Pratipaksha Bhavana is a form of cognitive reappraisal, deliberately shifting how you interpret a situation to change its emotional charge. And it is one of the best supported emotion regulation strategies in psychology and a central mechanism of cognitive behavioral therapy, the most evidence-based psychotherapy for anxiety and depression. Note one refinement, modern research adds, reappraisal, actively cultivating a different view, is effective, whereas suppression, just pushing the thought down, tends to backfire, which is exactly Patanjali's instruction. He says, cultivate the opposite. The ancient technique and the modern evidence agree precisely. A related, subtler tool sits alongside it, where Pratipaksha Bhavana actively substitutes a better thought. The meditative skill of decentering from the inner limbs simply observes the negative thought as a passing mental event without believing or fighting it. Both are valuable and they suit different moments. Reappraisal, when you need to shift a stuck interpretation. Decentering, when you need to stop feeding a thought by struggling with it at all. Skilled practitioners use both. Waking with the kleshas. Recall the five afflictions from chapter 7. Ignorance, avidya, ego, asmita, attraction, raga, aversion, dvesha, and clinging to life, abhinivesha. Patanjali does not just diagnose them, he prescribes how to reduce them. Sutra 2.10 says, the subtle kleshas are thinned by tracing them back to their origin, turning the mind inward through meditation to their root in ignorance. And 2.11 says their active grosser forms are reduced by dhyana, meditation. In other words, the afflictions are worked on at two levels. The everyday gross reactions are calmed by ongoing meditative practice, and the deep roots are addressed by the clear seeing that mature practice brings. Practically, this gives you a two-tier approach to your own reactivity. At the gross level, in the heat of a reaction, use the immediate tools, the pause and breath, ahimsa, pratipaksha, bhavana, cultivate the opposite, and decentering, watch the wave without being swept off. These handle the flare-up in the moment. At the root level, over months and years of practice, the meditative clarity gradually thins the afflictions themselves, so the flares become less frequent and less intense. You notice over time that the things that used to reliably hook you, a certain kind of criticism, a certain craving, have lost some of their grip. This is the slow, real fruit of practice, and it is worth more than any peak experience. Not that you never react, but that the automatic compulsive quality of reaction loosens and a gap opens up in which you can choose. This is what the entire system is for. Not blissful states, not powers, not even calm for its own sake, but a mind progressively freed from being run by its own conditioned reactions, resting more and more in the clear awareness that was there underneath the waves the whole time. Part V programs, turning it into a life. Knowledge you do not practice is just decoration. This part turns the whole system into concrete routines. Adapt everything to your real life. The best program is the one you will actually do consistently, which is the whole lesson of Abhyasa 1.14 and of habit science alike. 19. A day built on the sutras. You do not need hours. A well-designed day threads the practice through ordinary life. Here is a full template. Take from it what fits. On waking, before reaching for the phone, this is Pratyahara and Brahmacharya. Do not let the day's stimulation hijack your mind before you have claimed it. Take a minute of slow breathing. Set a simple intention drawn from the yamas or niyamas. One quality to embody today. For example, today, ahimsa in my speech. Morning practice, the anchor of the day. This is your main formal sit when the mind is quietest. A few minutes of slow, long exhale breathing to settle pranayama, your seated meditation. Begin with focused attention on the breath, dharana, letting it settle into flow, dhyana, optionally open into monitoring awareness. Start at 10 minutes, build toward 20. If you do physical yoga or movement, Here is a natural place for it, as preparation in its true role as asana, through the working day. This is where most of the practice actually lives. The limbs are for life, not just the cushion. Single task, pratyahara, one thing at a time. Senses gathered, phone out of sight during focused work. The pause, ahimsa.
It's
notice the small lies and the small cruelties and decline them. Honor time and credit. Asteya, be punctual. Name others' contributions. Enough moments. Santosha. A few times a day. Register sufficiency. Right now, I have what I need. Evening. As stimulation should wind down. Brahmacharya. Socha of the mind. A device curfew before bed. Low stimulation wind down. This also protects sleep, which protects everything. Gratitude, Santosha. Name three specific things from the day you are glad of. Brief self-study, Swadhyaya. Couple of honest lines. Where did I react today and why? What pattern showed up? No self-attack. Just seeing. Surrender, Ishvara Pranidhana. Mentally hand over the day, the wins, the failures, the unfinished, and release the grip on tomorrow. Optional short evening sit or simply a few minutes of slow breathing to transition towards sleep. The whole formal load can be as little as 15 to 20 minutes of practice bookending a day that is lived through the limbs. That is sustainable, and sustainable is what works. 20. An 8-week beginner progression. Do not try to install all 8 limbs at once. That violates both tapas, which favors one keystone at a time, and the science of habit. Layer them gradually. Each week, keep everything from prior weeks and add one new element. If a week feels shaky, repeat it before moving on. There is no price for speed. Week 1, the seat and the breath. Establish a daily 5-minute practice at a fixed time. Sit, chapter 12, and do slow, long exhale breathing. Resonance breathing 6 per minute. Goal this week, show up every day. That is it. You are building the container. Week 2, concentration. Keep the setup. Now add focused attention meditation on the breath for 5-10 minutes after the breathing. Expect constant mind wandering. Remember, the return is the practice. Goal, notice and return without self-judgment. Week 3, one yama. In life, take up ahimsa. Specifically, watch your speech and your inner critic for a week. Add an evening gratitude practice, Santosha, three specific things nightly. Week 4, pratyahara, attention hygiene, keep all prior. Notifications off, phone out of the room during practice and focused work. No phone on waking. Practice single tasking. Notice how much steadier attention becomes. Week 5. Lengthen and deepen. Extend meditation toward 15 minutes. Introduce open monitoring for the last few minutes. After settling with the breath, simply watch whatever arises with equanimity. Add a second yama or niyama that speaks to you. For example, satya or socha as your life focus. Week 6, Swadhyaya. Keep practicing. Add brief evening self-study. A few honest journal lines on your reactions and patterns. Begin reading the sutras or wisdom texts slowly, a little at a time. Week 7. Pratipaksha Bhavana. Keep all prior. Add the reframing tool when a harmful or agitating pattern grips you. Deliberately cultivate the opposite, chapter 17. Practice it in real moments, not just in theory. Week 8. Extend meditation toward 20 minutes if it is comfortable. At the end of day surrender practice, Ishvara Pranidhana. Hand over the day, release control of tomorrow. Step back and review which limbs feel alive, which need attention. Design your ongoing personal daily rhythm from chapter 19, keeping what works. After 8 weeks, you will not be enlightened. No honest book promises that. But you will have a real personal daily practice touching all 8 limbs. And the beginnings of the steadier, kinder, less reactive mind the whole system aims at. From here, it is abhyasa. Long, uninterrupted, earnest continuation. 1.14. Troubleshooting. Troubleshooting, I cannot stop my mind from wandering. You are not supposed to stop it. You are supposed to notice and return. A wandering mind that you keep bringing back is a working practice, not a failing one. This is the single most common misunderstanding. Reread chapter 15.1. I do not have time. 5 minutes counts and beats zero. Consistency at a tiny dose beats occasional long sessions. Shrink the practice until it is impossible to skip, then let it grow on its own. I keep falling asleep. Usually one of you are sleep deprived. Fix the sleep. It is foundational. You are practicing lying down, sit up, or the room is too warm and dim, more light, cooler, eyes slightly open. Dullness is one of Patanjali's named obstacles, chapter 16, adjust conditions. It is not working. I feel nothing. Doubt is a named obstacle, 120, not a verdict. Benefits are cumulative and often invisible day to day. You notice them in a slightly longer pause before reacting, a slightly steadier week, not in dramatic session experiences. Give it 8 weeks of consistency before judging and drop the expectation of dramatic states. Chasing them, raga, blocks the quiet benefits that are actually arriving. I got bored, lost motivation. Motivation is unreliable. That is what tapas is for. You practice because it is time, not because you feel like it. Recommit to one keystone practice, held without exception. Boredom in meditation is also worth watching as an object. Meditation is making me anxious, stirring up difficult stuff. Take this seriously. See the safety box in chapter 15. Ease off intensity and duration. Favor shorter sits and more grounding practices. Slow breathing, body scan, open-eyed practice. If it persists or destabilizes you, seek a qualified teacher. And if you have a mental health history, a professional experience with meditation-related difficulty. Backing off is wisdom. I am inconsistent. I keep stopping and restarting. This is the normal texture of a real practice, not a disqualification. Each restart is fine, just restart. Attaching the practice to a fixed cue, same time, same place, right after an existing habit, and keeping the minimum dose tiny are the two most effective fixes, both straight from habit science. Which should I prioritize if I can only do one thing? A daily short sit of concentration meditation plus favoring slow breathing when stressed. Those two carry a large share of the benefit for the least time. Everything else enriches from there. Appendix B. The evidence honestly. A book that claims science backing owes you a plain account of how good that backing actually is. Here is the honest summary. Slow breathing, 6 breaths per minute, long exhale, reliably shifts the nervous system toward calm. This is solid, replicated physiology. Cyclic sighing has strong recent trial support for lifting mood. Meditation produces modest but real reductions in anxiety, depression, and pain, and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy meaningfully prevents depression relapse. The mechanism of benefit, reduced rumination and increased decentering, is well evidenced and maps directly onto Patanjali's core definition. Self-compassion over harsh self-criticism, gratitude practice, acceptance of the uncontrollable, the ACT model, and a clear sense of purpose all have good support and align with specific limbs. Materialism and grasping reliably undermine well-being. Yoga as movement is a legitimate, safe, moderately beneficial form of exercise. What is real but modest, and often no better than the alternatives? This is the single most important calibration in the book, and it comes from the most rigorous source available, Goyal and colleagues' 2014 JAMA Internal Medicine Review. Meditation's benefits are real but small, effect sizes around 0.3, and they frequently do not exceed what you would get from exercise, medication, or other credible intervention. Much of the apparent meditation effect in weaker studies is non-specific. Attention, expectancy, group support, and shrinks against active controls. This is a reason to practice for reliable ordinary benefits, not for exceptional ones. What is overstated or oversold? Dramatic rewiring your brain claims the structural effects come from small, bias-prone, mostly observational studies and the best-controlled randomized trials to date, Kral et al., 2022 N as approximately 218 found no MBSR-induced structural brain change at all. Telomere lengthening and reverse aging claims, thin and mixed evidence. The most oversold area of all. The popular 40% of happiness is in your control figure does not hold up. Loving kindness meditation literally boosting cardiac vagal tone. The specific claim failed reanalysis, though its mood benefits are real. 66 days to build a habit. As a precise number, it was a median with a huge range. Grit as a distinct predictor of success, largely just conscientiousness rebranded. The general problems with this whole research area state them plainly. You cannot blind people to whether they are meditating. So placebo and expectancy effects are large. Waitlist controls inflate results. Publication bias means small positive studies dominate. Yoga and mindfulness are umbrella terms covering widely different practices, and adverse events are underreported. The bottom line, these practices deliver a calmer, more collected, less reactive mind, and modest but genuine improvements in stress, mood, and several health markers, reliably, safely, at low cost. It is not magic, and anyone promising transformation, cures, or superpowers is selling something the evidence does not support, practiced for what they actually give. The methods in this book are among the best supported, self-directed things a person can do for their mind. Practiced in pursuit of miracles, they disappoint. Patanjali himself warned against chasing the spectacular. Appendix C, Safety Guide. Most of this book is very low risk. Concentrate your caution on two areas. Breathing practices. Make slow, gentle, 6 breaths per minute breathing your foundation. It is safe for almost everyone. Treat forceful and breath-holding techniques as advanced and optional. Never do rapid hyperventilation, breathing, Kapalabhati, Bhastrika, power breathing, Wim Hof style, cyclic hyperventilation, or breath holds in or near water, or while driving, risk of blackout and drowning, shallow water blackout, or loss of vehicle control. Forceful breathing and prolonged retention are contraindicated in pregnancy, uncontrolled high blood pressure or cardiovascular disease, epilepsy or seizure disorders, recent stroke, aneurysm, glaucoma, and serious psychiatric conditions. Stop if you feel dizzy, tingly, or faint. Learn advanced techniques from a qualified teacher and get medical clearance if you have a significant condition. For most people, most of the time, it is safe and beneficial, but intensive practice can provoke psychological difficulty In one study of people who had completed a mindfulness program, Britton et al., 2021, about 14% had a negative effect that lasted at least a day, and about 6% had one that lasted a month or longer, including anxiety, dissociation, depersonalization, and perceptual or emotional disturbances. These are more likely with long retreats, high daily doses. Build gradually, avoid jumping into intensive retreats as a beginner. If practice consistently stirs distress or destabilizing states, ease off toward shorter, more grounding practices and seek a qualified teacher. If you have a significant mental health history, work with a professional experienced in meditation-related difficulty. General, this book complements professional medical and psychological care. It does not replace it. If you are in crisis or thinking about harming yourself, that comes before any practice here. Contact your local emergency number or findahelpline.com and befrienders.org will route you to your country's crisis line. Physical yoga carries ordinary exercise risks. Work within your range and stop at sharp. Appendix G, the one-page practice. Everything in this book compressed to something you could pin above your desk. If you only ever use this page, you are still practicing yoga in Patanjali's sense. The daily minimum, about 15 to 20 minutes on waking, 1 minute of slow breathing before the phone. Name one quality to embody today. Morning sit, settle with a few long exhale breaths, then rest attention on the breath. When the mind wanders, notice and return. Start at 10 minutes. Through the day, one thing at a time. A breath before you react. A reset of slow breathing. When stress spikes, watch your words. A few, this is enough, pauses. Evening. Screens down early. Name three good things from the day. A line or two of honest self-reflection. Hand over what you cannot control. The one breath to know in for about 4 seconds. Out for about 6, smooth and easy, roughly 6 breaths a minute. Use it daily and whenever you are stressed. It is the safest, best evidence practice in the book. The one rule of meditation. The mind wandering and you bringing it back is the practice. Not a failure at it. Every return is a rep, the 8-week ramp. Keep each week's work as you add the next. Sit daily, 5 minutes of slow breathing. Just show up. 2. Add focus attention meditation on the breath, 5 to 10 minutes. 3. Take up one yama. Start with ahimsa. Watch your speech and inner critic. Add nightly gratitude. 4. Notifications off, phone out of the room. Single task. 5. Lengthen toward 15 minutes. Add open monitoring. Add a second yama or niyama. 6. Add short evening self-study, read a little wisdom text. 7. Add cultivate the opposite, reframing in real moments. 8. Lengthen toward 20 minutes. Add the end of day surrender. Review and design your ongoing rhythm. The 8 limbs in one line each. Treat the world well, yama. Treat yourself well, niyama. Sit steady and at ease, asana. Regulate the breath, pranayama. Unhook attention from the senses, pratyahara. Concentrate, dharana. Let it flow, dhyana. And rest in absorption, samadhi. If it goes wrong, back off intensity, favor slow breathing and grounding, and get a qualified teacher. Backing off is wisdom, not failure. How this book was made, a book that asks you to test every claim, should be honest about its own making. I write as a practitioner. The shape of this book, what to include, where to trust the tradition and where to trust the evidence and what to leave out comes from my own reading and my own practice. I used AI tools to help draft and organize that material into prose, then edited it and checked every study and citation against its source. The sources are real. The effect sizes are quoted as the papers report them. And where the evidence is thin, I have said so rather than dress it up. the errors that remain. The book argues more than once against taking anyone's word for it, including mine. A named author is easy to turn into an authority to defer to instead of a method to test. Do not. The practices work, or they do not, in your own body and your own attention. The what the science says boxes are here so you can check the ground under each claim. Not so you can trust me for having cited it. So take what proves useful, test it against your own experience and against the sources. That is the method the book asks of you, and it applies first to the book itself. A closing word. Patanjali gave the whole game away in his second sentence. Yoga is the stilling of the fluctuations of the mind. Everything after the ethics, the breath, the posture, the meditation, the powers, the philosophy is in service of that one aim, and behind it a quieter promise. That underneath the churn of reaction and craving and fear, there is a clear awareness that was never actually disturbed, and that a person can learn slowly and patiently to rest. You will not do this perfectly, and you are not meant to. The practice is not a test you pass, but a direction you walk. A little more honesty, a little more kindness, a little more steadiness, a little less at the mercy of your own reactions, day after unremarkable day. The science says the gains are real and modest. The tradition says they compound over years into something like freedom. Both can be true. Begin small, begin today, and keep returning. Because, as Patanjali knew, and every meditator relearns each morning, the returning is the practice.